You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of September 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Guy Delorme, and Chloe Potter.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, extreme economic hardship in Greece has given oxygen to extreme politics in the country. How far will it go? Could civil war really lie around the corner?
Oscar Guardiola Rivera is the author of What If Latin America Ruled the World? He's in the studio to discuss today's news agenda. What do you have for us today, Oscar?
Today we have the politics of global catastrophe, from chemical weapons in Syria to spying in Latin America.
Thanks for that, Oscar. Plus, our Section D team decamped to Lisbon to investigate the city's third architecture triennale.
People are afraid of doing rehabilitation, renewal and construction, and think it's really difficult and costs a lot of money. So we need to give this information to people that step by step it's not that difficult and it's possible and people done it before.
All that, plus we'll check the Norwegian news, review the Turkish front pages, and quite possibly play some music too. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Police in Washington, D.C. say they're no longer looking for a second suspect in connection with Monday's shooting spree at the city's naval yard, in which 13 people, including the gunman, died. The gunman's been identified as 34-year-old Aaron Alexis from Fort Worth in Texas. He was a former Navy serviceman working as an IT subcontractor with secret clearance to the installation. Officials say he received a general discharge from the Navy Reserve in 2011 after a series of misconduct issues. Police have asked the public for help in establishing a motive for the shooting. Washington's chief of police, Kathy Lanier, praised the teams that first responded to the attack.
It certainly was one of the worst things we've seen in Washington, D.C. as officers entered the building and moved through the building. They were, making transmissions and keeping command informed is what they were coming across as they went through. Multiple victims. There was gunfire still going on. This is what we trained for. We were able to pull active shooter teams together.
A few hours after the attack, with tight security in place across Washington, a man was arrested after firecrackers were thrown over the north fence of the White House. Video of the incident showed agents apprehending a man dressed in shorts and a short-sleeved shirt before leading him away. The man, identified as Alexander Sahagian, is expected to be charged with throwing projectiles. Russia says there's no clear evidence that President Assad was behind a chemical attack in Syria last month. United Nations chemical investigators have confirmed the use of sarin gas near Damascus. As expected, the report doesn't say who launched the attack, but US, British and French envoys said technical details in the report pointed to government culpability. The US ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power.
Some countries did not accept on faith that the samples of blood and hair that the United States received from people affected by the August 21 attack contained sarin. But now Dr. Sellstrom's samples show the same thing. And it's very important to note that the regime possesses sarin, and we have no evidence that the opposition possesses sarin.
Salvage crews have completed raising the wreck of the Costa Concordia after a 19-hour-long operation which ended early this morning. The 300-metre-long liner had been lying on its side on rocks off the Italian island of Giglio after capsizing in January last year. One of the most complex and expensive maritime salvage operations ever attempted saw the 114,500-tonne ship pulled upright by a series of huge jacks and cables. It was then set on artificial platforms drilled into the rocky seabed. Franco Porcellacchia, leader of the Costa Cruz's technical team, says the operation was completed at around 4 a.m. without any significant problems.
The rotation happened the way we thought it would happen and the way we hoped it would happen. It was a perfect operation, I would say. And from the environmental point of view, I have to say that there are no evidence so far of any impact to the environment.
The The Bangladeshi Supreme Court has rejected an appeal by Islamist leader convicted of war crimes and increased his life sentence to the death penalty. In February, a special tribunal convicted Abdul Qader Mullah on 5 charges, including murder. The 65-year-old Assistant Secretary General of the Jamaat-e-Islami Party was accused of being responsible for a series of killings during the 1971 War of Independence with Pakistan. His conviction sparked angry protests in which at least 100 people died. At least 41 people have been killed as 2 powerful storms converged on Mexico's Gulf and Pacific coasts. Tens of thousands of people have been evacuated amid some of the worst flooding in decades. At least 21 people died in the popular resort of Acapulco. Thousands of people have been stranded by flight cancellations and closed roads. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. It's 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London,
Londres.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
From London,
London, London,
Caracas.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. Just coming up to 14:07 in Jakarta, 10:07 in Beirut, and 08:07 here in London. And it's time now to set the day's news agenda. Here to do it, Oscar Guardiola Rivera of Birkbeck University, right here in London. And Oscar, understandably, top of the agenda is this shooting at a US naval facility.
That's correct. I mean, it's the politics of catastrophe all around the globe. Aaron Alexis, who had been arrested in Seattle in 2004 for an anger fuel shooting, has been named as the man behind the Navy Yard shootings that yesterday claimed the lives of at least 12 people, if not 13. The naval base in Washington was rocked by a mass shooting on Monday after Alexis opened fire and left 13 people dead. This is the worst attack on a military base in the U.S. since the Fort Hood killings back in 2009.
I'm just curious about this detail which has emerged, that he was arrested in 2004. A curious phrase, an anger-filled shooting. That sounds like the sort of person who shouldn't be wandering around.
Absolutely the case. Not only that, the other detail that has emerged is that he was, in fact, a former petty officer, third class, who served full time in the Naval Reserve until 2011. And these, it seems important to link this to one commentary made yesterday by Binghamton professor James Petrus, who said that perhaps we should look at the cause of this in the breakdown of conflict resolution institutions within the United States, which he said is pushing both civilians and the state to resort to violence rather than engaging in conversations to
Oscar, do we have any clues about motivation? We certainly have some clues. Has anything been stated by the authorities?
But again, the only thing that has been said is these two elements, anger-fueled, and it seems to be the case that since he was serving, working with the Navy until so recently, there may be some sort of problem or some sort of unresolved issue with his former employers.
It's certainly a case that with the increased deployments of forces around the world to these conflicts, we've seen cases, for example, in the UK, where now I think the number of suicides of former service people is higher than the number of people who are actually killed on combat duty. There are definitely unresolved mental health issues. Is anything being done to address that?
Not much. And in fact, it is also the case, particularly in the United States, that this affects particular sectors of the population. For instance, Latinos in the U.S. are overrepresented in the army. And this particular community is feeling the effects of this, which is why their families actually have come out so strongly against the sort of U.S. foreign policy that we have seen so far.
Oscar, turning to another story that continues to dominate the headlines, and that's Syria. UN report has now confirmed a chemicals weapon attack did take place. It seemingly the sides, Russia, the US, still sticking to their guns on who was responsible. Tell us the latest on that.
Well, it has been said from the very outset that the evidence seems to point in the direction of the Syrian government. Still, we're talking about circumstantial evidence. But at least, as Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, put it yesterday, now we know that the conclusions drawn on the report are overwhelming and indisputable. As he put it, the attack on Ghouta on 21st August was the most significant confirmed use of chemical weapons against civilians since Saddam Hussein used them in Halabja in 1988.
We heard a clip in the news of a US official saying that now all those people who wouldn't take it on faith that sarin had been deployed must now see that there's evidence. And the implication of all this was you should listen to what we're saying to you and trust us. But there doesn't seem to be the mood to do that.
Actually, it's quite problematic that she put it that way.
No kidding.
Because now the criticism that was made has also been confirmed in a sense that they were asking us to take all this on faith. And actually, the evidence that now has been presented, although it might be read in that direction, it's still circumstantial, and it wasn't the mandate of the UN to actually apportion blame. So on top of that, there are also other revelations emerging yesterday about sarin gas produced, likely it was produced in Iraq, being smuggled into Syria, and the destination was the rebels, as al-Nusra in particular. So there are still doubts.
But of course, as Aum Shinrikyo showed in Japan, the most infamous use of sarin, you can make it yourself.
That's the other thing. I mean, we have been told that actually you need some sort of high technical specifications to be able to use it. But as you pointed out, the people who used it in Japan had no means of, particularly sophisticated means of delivery. So it can be used in more ways than one.
And finally, the United States, unpopular for another reason, following the revelations of Snowden, Brazil and Argentina pledging to cooperate more closely in response to those revelations.
And this is the case of incredible bad timing. I mean, this week marks the 40th anniversary of U.S. intervention in Latin America, in Brazil and Chile in particular, and in Argentina. And here we are, 40 years later, the defense minister of Brazil telling the Argentine defense minister that we need to reflect on how we cooperate to face these new forms of attack. That's a very, very charged language. The ministers have signed a broader military cooperation agreement on Friday, and the countries have agreed that later this year, Brazil will host a bilateral cybersecurity meeting and will start training Argentinian officials and officials from other countries in Latin America to guard them against cyber attacks from the US.
They're sounding more confident about their ability to stand alone now, the countries of Latin America, understandably, as their economies progress. I think it was very interesting they're now taking independent attitudes to the so-called war on drugs, which was always the United States war, really. Maybe this is expanding the attitude.
That's very true. I mean, a page had been turned in the history of the Americas. And actually, the other important element in this piece of news is that most of this spying had to do with economic data. It was economic spying rather than security. So clearly the US knows that things are going good south of the border.
Oscar, thank you very much for joining us. Oscar Guardiola Rivera there, author of What If Latin America Ruled the World?
Many thanks.
Yes, it may indeed do. Many thanks for coming in, as always.
Always a pleasure.
Coming up, after a violent attack on a Communist Party event by supporters of Golden Dawn and a protest in response by thousands of people in Athens, we review the state of politics in Greece.
Monocle 24 are heading down under. This week, we'll be broadcasting two special editions of The Globalist from the heart of Melbourne and Sydney. On Thursday, September the 19th, we'll be at Federation Square in Melbourne, where we'll hear from the city's mayor, the lead architect behind the Flinders Street Station redesign, and the best and brightest from the world of literature and culture. On Friday, September the 20th, we'll be broadcasting live from the iconic Sydney Opera House. Mayor Clover Moore will join us to talk about the city's future. We'll speak to the man in charge of the country's largest media business. Plus, we speak to the CEO of Australian Wolf and the people leading Sydney's music and dining scene. That's a very special Australian edition of The Globalist, live from Melbourne on Thursday and live from Sydney on Friday. Tune in to The Globalist at 1500 hours Australian East Coast time, 6 a.m. in London, and 2200 hours in San Francisco.
Extreme economic hardship often leads to extreme politics, as it has done in Greece with the far-right Golden Dawn Party winning 18 parliamentary seats in the elections in June. Black-shirted neo-Nazi supporters of the group are now making their presence felt with violence against members of the Communist Party, and that in turn has led thousands to take to the streets in protest. Some analysts believe the atmosphere in the country, as it navigates a sixth consecutive year of recession, is even becoming ripe for civil war.
Well, to get more on this, we're joined in the studio by Greece analyst and author of Greek Culture Smart, Constantine Buhea. But first, though, let's go to Athens now and talk to Monocle's correspondent there, Natalie Savarikas. Natalie, as we mentioned, some people are using the words civil war. Is this a real fear that people have?
Well, what we're experiencing here is a clear division, if you like, between the far right and left-wing parties and groups here. So yes, we are experiencing a big divide, and of course this is all happening because of the financial crisis that now has turned, of course, into a big political crisis. These words were even used, I mean, as a civil war terminology was actually even used by the government spokesman himself to, if you like, point to Golden Dawn's activity and criticize it, especially as many had started, suspecting that Golden Dawn might team up with the New Democracy, the leading party of the coalition government.
Natalie, the violence, the recent very violent attack against members of the Communist Party, what impact has that had on support for Golden Dawn?
Well, it's really interesting, actually, because whenever Golden Dawn has used violence to express itself, at the beginning, most people here would expect its popularity to fall, and quite interestingly, it hasn't. It has actually skyrocketed. I mean, the recent polls suggest that Golden Dawn is definitely the only party in Greece that has been able to capitalize so much on the financial crisis. It has nearly doubled its percentage, and that's, of course, according to polls. And if it were to be elected, it'd be the third most popular party, not elected, if we were to hold elections, it would be the third most popular party in Parliament. So it's really difficult to gauge exactly what the mood is, but I can tell you for sure that the popularity is skyrocketing.
Constantine, bearing in mind the history of Greece, and this is within living memory as well, it does seem unwise for any politician to be using this phrase civil war, which I find quite extraordinary.
Indeed, they're using both war allusions plus ancient Greek, like the 300 Thermopylae, the Spartans defending the savage invaders, and depending on who wishes to be the good guy uses those analogies. But the future of what's going to happen immediately in Greece depends very much on a German lady whom the Germans called Mutti, or Mumsy in English, and whom the Greeks call Fraulein Hitler. Her name is Chancellor Merkel, and they're having elections. It looks like Mrs. Merkel's party will win, and she will push for austerity measures even further, stronger austerity measures in Greece. Further austerity measures in Greece means more upheaval. More upheaval means a strengthening of Golden Dawn. So all these things that are happening in Europe are very closely linked.
Constantine, Do you think that the activism, such as this violent attack on the communists on Friday, is a sign that Golden Dawn are not getting what they want through legitimate channels, despite winning those parliamentary seats, and are still really at the outer edges of politics? Do they know what they're doing now they're in mainstream politics?
I think Golden Dawn are using the streets as their gym. Every so often they go down and then sort of swing a few batons, bang a few heads, knock a few people over. It's a sort of natural tactics for them. The thing to bear in mind about Golden Dawn, it's a very closed circle of activists, let's say, unfortunate activists. Very few people I allow to go in. I've tried to sort of talk to them. It's been impossible. I only talk to them secondhand. Therefore, how this tight, inward-looking group will survive is anyone's guess.
Isn't the government playing a dangerous game here by invoking... I mean, I find this a bit fascinating, as you might have gathered, because I keep asking about it, you know, civil war, Greek history, Spartans defending the city, etc., etc. Aren't they giving Golden Dawn a little too much credit here? And don't they risk inflating it to a size which it doesn't actually have? You say it's a very small coterie of activists. Why make it more than that?
Greek discourse has always liked to use very strong images. For instance, when there's a forest fire, they will use the expression, everything is burning. When there's a terrorist attack, everybody who does anything is alluded to terrorism. Now you've got the fascists and Golden Dawn, everything alludes around civil war. The antidote to this, the really great antidote to this, is Greek public cynicism towards the media. And they are keeping back from it all and simply putting their vote in Golden Dawn up to 10% as a protest vote. It is not an espousal of their nasty fascist ideology. Greek cynicism, perhaps, is the great saviour of Greece for the time being.
Natalie, returning to you in Athens, what is the current atmosphere on the streets of Athens? Does it feel like things are bubbling up?
Absolutely. What we've seen since yesterday is essentially it's Monday's kicked off a week of protests and strikes, and that's because essentially public sector unions here are protesting, if you like, the layoff of thousands of the government employees, and especially teachers and all staff at schools. And of course, they're very worried, of course, about looming wages as cuts in wages as well. So a lot of concern here and fear of what this third bailout that we're hearing, and that, of course, came out of Germany first, might mean for Greece. There is inevitably... Greece has many funding gaps that needs to be addressed. Greece will need more money. That's what the Troika is here to inspect. Inspectors of the Greece's international creditors are here to check on the books. A third bailout is necessary, but of course the Greeks, of course, are very worried at what cost, what other austerity measures will be implemented, and how much more pain will they have to take.
Well, Natalie Savarikas, Monocle's correspondent in Athens, many thanks for joining us. Constantine Buhea, just one last thing. From what Natalie and yourself have both been saying, an issue here is that the Greek people, in fact, don't seem to have their own destiny under control at the moment. How do they get that back without resorting to extremism?
They don't get back their destiny. When you have such a giant debt, $300 billion, and it's mounting, your destiny is completely out of your hands. Therefore, what you can do is manage this discontent rather than hand back a country its economic destiny. That's impossible.
Well, Constantine Buhea, many thanks for joining us here in the studio. And thanks very much again to Natalie Savarikas in Athens.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Opp London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europa.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
It's 8:24 in London, and it's time now to take a look at what's making the news in Norway. Lars Bevanger, our man who covers the region, joins us on the line. Welcome to the show, Lars.
Good morning.
So, first up, a political story is dominating.
Yes, there is a new government coming into power in October. We had elections in Norway last week. And the centre-right coalition led by the Conservative Party won a majority in Parliament. And now they've started their discussions. There are four parties on the centre-right, and they've started discussions this week to try to agree on a coalition platform. Now, this is not going to be easy. The Conservatives is the largest of the parties, and they've agreed on one thing, and that is who's going to be Prime Minister, and that's going to be Erna Solberg, the leader of the Conservatives. But on many other issues, they differ widely. So the papers and all the media are now keenly following these discussions to see who's in and who's out. We don't know yet whether all four of the parties will form a government, or whether it'll be three, or maybe a minority government consisting of just two of them.
You know what I like, Lars, is the fact we've got a Google Translate version of a newspaper article about this, describing them, these four particular actors in this, as the bourgeois parties. Is this an accurate reflection of the particular political parties who may make up this coalition?
No, I don't think so. I think we'll have to put
shame.
That one down to Google, I'm afraid. It's just that the Norwegian word for centre-right is Borgerlig, which, yes, is directly translated as bourgeois, but there's very little bourgeois left of any of these parties. I guess the only one would be the Conservatives if you wanted to push that one particular one. But there's another party, which is the Liberals. They are very much like the Lib Dems here. Wouldn't call them bourgeois, maybe some of them, but not all of them.
Lars, another prominent story relates to a biography of Anda Behring Breivik's mother. Tell us about the controversy over that.
This is a book which has not yet been finished, and it's written by a former journalist who befriended Anders Behring Breivik's mother and had many meetings with her, and they agreed together to write a biography about her. So she wanted her story to be told, and the problem is that soon before she died earlier this spring, she pulled out of the project, and she also, according to her now lawyer, expressed the wishes for the project to be pulled. She didn't want this book to come out. She was afraid that it wasn't going to tell the story she wanted to tell. However, the journalist wants to press on with writing the book, and she says this is too important a part of Norwegian history not for this story also to be told. And it's now looking to be a fight, perhaps, in the courts between the author and the lawyer of the now deceased mother of Anders Behring Breivik. So that's one to watch. And of course, if the book is published in the end, I would have thought it would create quite a lot of interest, both in Norway and perhaps abroad as well.
Is she interesting in her own right, beyond being the mother of a notorious murderer?
Well, this is the point that a lot of people want to try to find out what happened. How did Anders Breivik become what he became? And of course, people will be looking to his youth. We know a little bit about what happened in his childhood and his relationship to his mother, because this came out in the court case against him last year. And people will want to try to find some kind of trace and maybe some kind of explanation to see what happened there to create this monster, which he is in many people's eyes in Norway. Whether this book will provide any answers, we still don't know. But if it is published, I think it will be read with interest by quite a few people.
And your final story is also was touching on psychological issues and the danger that they pose to society. There are questions about whether the authorities are doing enough to protect people from individuals with dangerous psychological issues after several murders.
Yes, there's two court cases at the moment dealing with two murders that happened last year, last autumn, and in both cases the defendants have been found to have been psychologically unstable at the time of the crime. Now, these are ongoing cases, so no one's been sentenced here yet, but in Norway the system is such that court-appointed psychiatrists will deliver their their verdict, if you like, before the court case is over. But the court case will then continue regardless of the state of mind of the person. But in both cases, they have concluded that these were people who were mentally unstable, and consequently, the debate now is reignited, because we've had cases like this in the past. The debate is reignited over whether there's enough support for people who have been psychiatrically ill and who are medicated and released back into society, and also whether society has got enough protection against people who remain unstable and who go on to carry out heinous acts like murder. But of course, the vast majority of people who are psychologically ill do not commit any crime.
Well, many thanks for joining us, Lars. That's Lars Bavanger covering this morning's Norwegian stories.
In the next half hour of the programme, we'll review the Turkish front pages and we'll head to Lisbon with our design team, who've been at the Architecture Triennale taking place in the city.
People are afraid of doing rehabilitation, renewal and construction, and think it's really difficult and costs a lot of money. So we need to give this information to people that step by step it's not that difficult and it's possible and people done it before.
But first, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Chloe. Police in Washington, D.C. say they're no longer looking for a second suspect in connection with Monday's shooting spree at the city's naval yard, in which 13 people, including the gunman, died. The gunman's been identified as 34-year-old Aaron Alexis, who was a former Navy serviceman working as an IT subcontractor at the yard. A few hours after the attack, a man was arrested after firecrackers were thrown over the White House fence. Russia says there's no clear evidence that President Assad was behind a chemical attack in Syria last month. A UN report has confirmed the use of sarin gas in the attack, but it doesn't say who launched it. US, British and French envoys, though, say technical details point to government culpability. Salvage crews have completed raising the wreck of the Costa Concordia after a 19-hour-long operation which ended early this morning. The liner had been lying on its side on rocks off the Italian island of Giglio after capsizing in January last year. The Bangladeshi Supreme Court has rejected an appeal by an Islamist leader convicted of war crimes and increased his life sentence to the death penalty. In February, a special tribunal convicted Abdul Qader Mullah on 5 charges, including murder. At least 41 people have been killed as 2 powerful storms converged on Mexico's Gulf and Pacific coasts. Tens of thousands of people have been evacuated amid some of the worst flooding in decades. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Chloe Potter, and Guy Delaunay. Handsome Lisbon is a fitting host for Portugal's third Architecture Triennale. Its vibrant, cobbled and cramped streets, lined in pastels, marble and signature blue and white tiles, tell of its former grandeur. But empty and boarded up buildings tell another story. There's a reason why Portugal is the P in pigs, along with Ireland, Italy, Greece and Spain, and the economy has gone through a torrid time.
So this year's triennial, see what I did there, Chloe, is part celebration of new talent, part call to arms for a generation adapting to the reality of the situation. There are events and workshops to remind young architects that there really is work to be had. And tonight on Monocle 24, Section D will come entirely from Lisbon. For a sneak preview, David Pleasant takes to the Rua to find those promoting innovation.
I've come here to the Praça Figueira Square in the heart of Lisbon to meet a group of local architects, designers and journalists that are taking part in the Crisis Busters programme, being supported by the Architecture Triennale this year. The idea is that with a tiny bit of investment, many groups can realise a multitude of small projects that can have a big impact on communities and society as a whole here in the city. I'm going to go and meet some of the architect activists who, with megaphones in hand, are making presentations at the base of the grand old statue of a mounted King Pedro I in the centre of the square.
My name is Joanna, I'm from Arteria, the office, and my project is about the view we are setting here. We are in Praça da Figueira. It's a square with a lot of empty buildings around us. And this happens because people are afraid of doing rehabilitation, renewal and construction, and think it's really difficult and costs a lot of money. So we need to give this information to people that step by step it's not that difficult and it's possible, and people done it before.
So you're documenting every empty building in yeah. Lisbon, is that
we
right?
We're constructing a database of the empty buildings all around Lisbon. We have this beta phase already done of Pena, this district behind us. And we are documenting all these empty buildings. We are calling real estates to understand where they are and to show them to people, show the pictures.
I'm interested in, if we're talking about design, how do we relate your skills as a designer, as an architect? What are you trying to do with this project? How do you kind of make that transition? How do you kind of tie the two together?
Arteria Studio is about rehabilitation only. So we do what we have to do as architects, being our age in Lisbon. And somehow architects were very interested in the past few years in new construction. And by many reasons, Lisbon is in this state right now. So we decided we have to picture this territory. This territory is a territory of action, and we have to know it so we can act on it.
So do you feel as architects your skills as designers are more urgently needed?
Yes, it is. Also, it's a work that has not been developed. So you have somehow, it's raw material. We have raw material.
That was Anna Jara at Arteria Studio. Around the corner on the other side of this rather windy square, are yet more architects intervening and re-evaluating their city.
My name is Noura Al-Khassaouni. The project is on restaurants that are closing down because of the economic crisis. And we were interested in highlighting this problem because in Portugal, restaurants are obviously very important, just as anywhere else. But they're a main social space in the city. So everyone goes out for lunch. Everyone has very long lunch breaks. And, you know, dining out is a very important part of being in Lisbon. So we were trying to find out why these spaces were very popular and why people would go to them regularly on a daily basis. And then I think as our research progressed, we realized that every space had its like very own specific thing that made it special. And there were very small things that, you know, seemed mundane for just a normal visitor, but it was the relationships that were developed between the, you know, chefs or like waiters and the customers that came in every day, or it was just like the comfort of knowing that these spaces have been there forever. So even if the food wasn't anything special, it was just them being there.
Back at the statue in the center of Praça Figueira, a more somber, almost militant mood has emerged.
There can be no democracy or representation without a free press. The invisible hand also failed at the distribution of ideas and knowledge. It takes a lot to produce free and conscious citizens. They must be tended to, removed from hunger, educated and empowered. Health, education, culture, food and democracy are needed. These are not luxuries, they are reasons to live.
My name is Manuel Henriques and I'm the executive director of the Lisbon Architecture Triennale.
If we talk about kind of themes or kind of a mood this time around in the Triennale, walking around and meeting architects, obviously the economic crisis is not very far from people's lips, minds. Not that that's a particularly new topic. Are we at a point that we can conclude or start to see some kind of result in terms of what people are talking or reactions to the crisis within the architecture community?
Well, I think people are definitely reacting because they now have no other choice. I could say that when we started to feel the crisis in our homes and in our jobs, in our offices, and then in 2011, it started to really feel like very strong. It was not only your friends, not friends of friends, it was already you and your very close friends. So I think everybody is finding other ways of living, and not only, they reduced a lot their offices, manpower reduced a lot, and there were a lot of architects that started teaching and that were not teaching before, to try to have an extra money at the end of the month. And a lot, but really a very big amount or number of architects, mostly the younger generation, just went away and to other countries to look for jobs. So in Portugal, I think there are a lot of new ways of practicing, not only the special practice, as we've been speaking by Beatriz Carle's words during this last year or this last month, but also other ways of working. Like architects are finding different businesses, at least here. And the Portuguese people are very creative people. So we are used to find ways to solve our problems, even if they are not that clear at the beginning or at the first glance.
The economic crisis has hit Portugal's architects hard, drastically reducing commissions, and an almost total collapse in public projects has led to thousands of job losses, and many to pack up their bags and move to Brazil, Angola, or even further afield. Many who remain, however, are not going to take the crisis lying down. Many see this as an opportunity and feel an immense sense of duty to keep designing. Whether that's designing solutions rather than buildings, many of Lisbon's architects are managing how to make use of limited resources and are helping to create new visions for the future of their city. For Monocle, in Lisbon, I'm David Pleasant.
I'm very, very, very envious of David Pleasant, Chloe.
Well, I know we were talking about Lisbon in the office earlier, and it sounds absolutely magical.
It is magical.
It's now top of my list of cities to visit.
It has some similarities with Belgrade, which is currently my home city, in that it's been slightly left behind economically. It's got lots of hills and trams and a great, vibrant culture. But we were also debating, having a heated debate. Triennale or triennial?
Let us know what you think. Let's just leave it there.
It's the eternal. Is it Bavaria Munich or is it Bayern München? That sort of thing, isn't it? Anyway, David and the rest of the Section D team were in Lisbon, and the entire edition of Section D, it's a special edition, is coming from Lisbon at 1900 London time tonight here on Monocle 24.
So don't miss it. You're listening to Midori House, and we'll be right back after this with a report on the Formula One of the sailing world. Alistair G reports on the America's Cup.
There's a touch of gold rush optimism on Fogo Island, the remote outpost off the coast of Newfoundland. Monocle Films journeyed to this idyll lost in time to witness reinvention at work.
Just living in that tangle with the North Atlantic breeds a kind of acute awareness of the natural. And I think it just makes you kind of quick and quick to a solution, quick to a response. And so that, I mean, you could call that entrepreneurial, but the ingenuity is all here. So really what we hope to do with our projects is just to kind of be the electric eel in the pond that helps with the connections.
Microloans meet macro ambitions on Fogo Island in the film section of monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is nearly 8:43 here in London and 43 minutes past midnight in San Francisco, which is where we head now.
And we're heading there under sail because the city is hosting the America's Cup, arguably the highest profile, highest cost open water event. Teams from seafaring nations jump aboard futuristic boats that almost fly as well as sail. But as Monocle's Alistair G reports, the Cup hasn't exactly enjoyed the universally rapturous reception. That's a difficult one to say, isn't it? Rapturous reception that its organisers would have liked.
On a freshly renovated pier on San Francisco Bay, thousands of people have gathered for a race between two ships, with futuristic sails that resemble the wing of an airplane and sleek, almost avian profiles. The flags of the United States and New Zealand flutter in the crowd of visitors.
Oh, absolutely amazing machines. Really good-looking boats, amazingly fast. And as soon as I saw them pop out of the water the first time, that's when I decided I was coming here.
It's a spaceship of
sailing. Yeah, I was about to say, a spaceship.
This is the America's Cup, one of the most prestigious sailing contests in the world and also the oldest major sporting event. This year's event in San Francisco has all the competitors sailing a specially designed boat called the AC-72, which travels at unheard-of speeds and even has the ability to hydrofoil, lifting almost completely out of the water as it races along at over 40 knots. But despite the technological breakthroughs, the competition has been mired in controversy, with fewer benefits to the host city than anticipated, and even the death of a sailor. For the competitors, the preparations for the Cup have taken years. Just ask Paul Kajard, the CEO of Sweden's Artemis, one of the teams that has competed for the Cup this year. Kajard, a native San Franciscan who has taken part in the Olympics and multiple America's Cups, says the training is intense.
The sailing team is in the gym every day at 7 o'clock, 7:30 till about 9. Breakfast, a briefing meeting, dock out at 11. Meanwhile, that the sailing team is doing that, the shore team is putting the boat in the water, putting the wing up, checking all the electronics, checking all the software. The tender team is getting all the tenders ready and the safety gear ready to support the boat during the day. And, you know, there's a 3 or 4 hour activity on the water.
He adds that the AC-72, while exhilarating, presents particular challenges.
Everything's fast, so that means that your reaction times have to be quicker, your anticipation has to be better. You chew up a mile in about 2 or 3 minutes. And so coming to the marks, the turning marks, you have to plan way far ahead.
Kajard's team was knocked out this summer, months after one of the Artemis crew was killed when the boat broke up on the water. And the Cup has been dogged by other problems. Originally, it was estimated that it would bring $1.4 billion of economic activity to the city, but that has since been revised down to less than a billion, and there are fewer visitors than expected. What's more, owing to the expense of the boats and the poor economy, only 4 teams entered the competition this summer: Italy, Sweden, New Zealand, and the US, and not the anticipated 15.
I think just about everyone in San Francisco, certainly people in the neighborhood, were very excited at the idea of America's Cup. The reality has been much more of a disappointment.
That's John Gollinger, a member of a neighborhood association in the tourist-friendly Telegraph Hill district. He blames the problems on politicians and on Larry Ellison, the billionaire CEO of Oracle, whose team won the previous America's Cup and so, according to the rules of the competition, was permitted to choose this year's host city and the type of boat used.
I mean, Larry Ellison and the America's Cup Event Authority, you know, really lobbied and pushed the city very hard 2 years ago to sign a deal right around Christmas time, very quickly, under the pressure of, we're going to take this somewhere else unless you give us a huge, incredibly sweet deal. And they made a lot of promises, and I think I don't know of anyone who would say those promises have come true. So I think, you know, City Hall also deserves a lot of blame, or the politicians were asleep at the wheel.
Still, those involved with the Cup's organization say it has by no means been a total bust. Norbert Bajorin is head of the Golden Gate Yacht Club, the official home of the defending USA team. He says that the problems are not the result of high-pressure lobbying, but rather merely a bad economy. He admits that the costly, high-performance boats were an idiosyncratic choice.
The 72s? Yeah, a little extreme, definitely, and we learned.
He argues that whatever issues have cropped up, San Francisco remains an ideal location for the Cup.
I mean, it is a natural amphitheater. I mean, it's a perfectly good bay. It's you can see from 360 degrees all around you. The sailing is competitive here. We got strong currents and strong ebbs against the wind. So to sail out here, it's not really for a novice. It's for professionals.
Back at the America's Cup Pier, those who have traveled around the world to see the racing aren't talking much about the problems the contest has faced.
Yeah, no, I love it. I think it's so exciting for New Zealand to be back in the America's Cup, and there's a real buzz at home, and yeah, it's good to hear lots of Kiwis over here too.
On the bay, meanwhile, the American and the New Zealand boats are heading out for their next race. Watching the spectators crowd at the railings, it's clear that the Cup has indeed brought money and visitors to San Francisco, just not quite in the amounts that the city was hoping for. For Monocle in San Francisco, I'm Alastair G.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Chloe Potter, and Guy Delaunay. Now, in a moment, we'll be taking a look at the Turkish front pages. But first, a bit of music to take us there. This is Mirkalım with Istanbul Beyler.
çekiyorlar karanlık dolapta. Elbiselerin arkasında bir ıslak sokak. İnanması güç, sen de vardın orada. İstanbul, İstanbul Beyoğlu'nda. Sarsıla, sarsıla. İstanbul, İstanbul Beyoğlu'nda.
Did we like Mir Kalam?
Well, it's certainly woken us all of us up.
I think we did.
Yeah,
I think we liked that. And that was all right. That was Mir Kalam with Istanbul Beyoğlu, and that was personally chosen by Monocle's Alexandra de Kramer, who is with us now. Hello.
Hi.
And you are not just here to talk about Turkish pop music, are you?
No, I'm going to start with the Turkish news headlines. So what's making headlines in a couple of newspapers is the restarting of Hrant Dink trial. And there was an interesting article in Radikal newspaper with his family, an interesting interview, but I just want to give a kind of a small background before. So Hrant Dink was assassinated. He was an editor. He's an Armenian-Turkish journalist and editor of Agos. It's the only Turkish-Armenian newspaper in Turkey. And he was assassinated in front of this the newspaper's doorstep, basically. And the trial has been ongoing for 6 years. The problem is this interview, while particularly chosen and I thought was interesting, was with his family, who have refused to take part in the trials because it has been ongoing for such a long time. And there were a couple of people that were charged with his murder, but ended up being released. One of them was a 17-year-old who was charged with killing Hrant Dink, but ended up not being charged for it because he was underage. He was only 17. So I think it's a really interesting case for Turkey, and he's become over the years a symbol of a lot of human rights protests, because he himself was a very outspoken activist, a human rights activist. And he unfortunately was charged by the Turkish government for being anti-Turkish because of a human rights speech he did, because our national anthem has this this phrase where he says, "I'm proud," like when you're singing it, like I'm proud to be a part of this heroic nation. And he said that he's actually, it doesn't sing that part, although he feels Turkish in his heart, that he doesn't agree with the words. And because of that, he was charged by being anti-Turkish and put on trial and actually sentenced to jail time for 6 months, which actually initially put him as a target for nationalist people that considered him Armenian. And like, we gave him the land and we gave him this education, but like, he doesn't even consider himself Turkish, which is kind of like a mishmash of like what's going on in Turkish politics.
So the trial has become a symbol for many things.
Exactly. And there are regular protests. A lot of people attend the trials. They're outside there and they chant. Usually they have, "We are all Hrant Dink, we're all Armenian," like Turkish people also attend these trials, which is really interesting. It's become kind of a human rights movement.
Well, there are issues, aren't there, with freedom of the press in Turkey? I mean, you alluded to this issue that if you say something which is considered to be anti-Turkish, you can land in it. And all these protests as well, there's definitely been pressure on the media, hasn't there?
Yeah, a lot of pressure, actually. And this was, mind you, in 2007. Somehow it has gone much worse in the recent years, like much more oppression. And because he's not the only journalist and that was killed during those years as well, which I believe is a loss for our nation, because if we are not outspoken about what's happening and we can't have a discussion, we can't fix things in the country as well.
Absolutely. Alex, there's also an aviation story you've got for us.
Yes. So Zaman newspaper announced that AtlasJet, which is kind of a small courier airline in Turkey. They have around 730 employees. It's more domestic. They do flights they're based in Istanbul, and they have a couple of flights to Iran, Iraq, have launched what is to be the first, together with a Kurdish group, Zagros Group, an airline called Zagros Jet, which is supposed to be the first airline of the Kurdish region. And I think it's interesting in many ways. First of all, that the Northern Iraq government that will have its own airline, which is, I think, a huge step. And it's going to be happening in October. And their first flight is going to be from Erbil to to Ankara.
And what have you been doing up until now if you want to fly to those parts of the world?
I think you have different airlines. You have Turkish Airlines flies there. I don't think Atlas Jet definitely flies to Iraq. But I think the significance is rather than it will be owned by a Kurdish group, which is a huge step. It means there's so much investment in that region and it's growing. And it's interesting that it wasn't just the Iraqi government that decided. It was Iraqi government and the Turkish government announced it together, which I think shows how much of a bigger role Turkey has started playing in northern Iraq and Kurdistan, basically.
Alexandra, we've just got time to hear about your another story making headlines, Turkey's first gay mayoral candidate.
Yes, that's an interesting one because we never had a gay mayor candidate. So Can Çavuşoğlu, a 43-year-old Turkish activist, has announced that he will run as an independent candidate in the Black Sea town of Bulancak. And it's really interesting because Karadeniz, the Black Sea region, is considered one of the more rural areas and people are more local and they're not that cosmopolitan, and it's interesting to see that he's going to be running in the elections in March. So
there we have it. I think that's all we have time for from Alex, isn't it?
Sadly, it is.
Alexander Kramer, were you going to do it?
I was going to.
Go on, you do it. You can have the honours.
Lovely, Alexander de Kramer. Many thanks, as always, for joining us. It's all we have time for today, I'm afraid. Thanks to our producers, Ali John and Barbara Feeney, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Matt Alagaya, our studio manager, Alex Funnell. Thanks, everyone.
Up next, after the news, we have The Entrepreneurs with Sophie Grove, who's in Istanbul at the moment, funnily enough. Dominic Reynolds and Georgina Godwin will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Guy Delorne.
And me, Chloe Potter.
Many thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.